Coexist number 13248, Reel 3.
Mr. Heal, Reel 3. How do you feel about the dams raid now in 1993?
Well, while the results hardly justified the number of crew we lost, some 56 crew, at the same time, the dams raid had a profound effect, I believe, on the morale of this country, because it came at a time when we were not getting any notable successes, and this showed in fact that we were actually achieving something. Bomber Command were flying over night after night after night and losing crews, and the only information we had on this subject, that is, I'm talking about the population there, was that every day so many aircraft were lost, so many crew were lost. And this must be, I mean, intensely depressing to think that we actually did what we wanted to do, what we intended to do, must have been a great help.
How well did you get to know Guy Gibson?
Not very well. I was a sergeant, he was a wing commander, and I had virtually nothing to do with him at all, really.
Now, what other raids with 617 do you most recollect, apart from the dams?
Well, the raids on the viaduct in the south of France and north of Italy, which was very important because Italy at the time was the subject of the Allied invasion, and there was a tremendous traffic between Italy and the south of France and the German influence there. And this, we actually attacked the Anthior viaduct three times without success, because it was so difficult. I'm glad to say that it was eventually broken in due course, but not by us. 617 was then put onto specific targets. Originally at low level. One of the most unfortunate was the Dortmund-Ems Canal in September. We at this time were then again on our 3-monthly leave. We came back from our leave to find that the day before 617 had attacked the Dortmund-Ems with the loss of 5 crews out of 8, 3 of the original crews and 2 replacements, and that as from then on we were forbidden to attack at low level unless specifically told to do so. So we started a new technique. We developed our own pathfinder, and with Gibson's skill, one of the main factors, and we would attack things like factories in occupied countries which were producing goods for the German war effort. And with these, we would fly around at 10,000 feet beforehand, 2 or 3 times, dropping flares to warn the workers that we were going to attack it and give them time to get away. And in fact, in one case, we did have a response indirectly from some of these workers to say they appreciated, they knew what we were doing, and they appreciated the care we took. Other targets that came up later in the year were the new V1 and V2 bases in the north of France. Although we didn't necessarily know what they were doing, we had a very good idea, and they required specific attack by the largest possible weapon to do any damage. And another target we attacked in was the Sommer Tunnel at the time of the invasion. And this tunnel was on the rail which carried the majority of the German forces and defences towards the point of invasion, so we are sure were a great help in that respect. We put that right out of action. There is in fact a photograph of the tunnel with a hole right in the middle of it. And so we were going on, and But come February 1944, Ken, the pilot, developed a hearing problem. And the next thing we knew, we were called in to the CO's office. Now, by this time, Gibson had been forcibly removed and sent on a propaganda exercise. Squadron leader Holden, who had taken over from him, had gone down on the Sorpy Dam, on the Dortmund-Ems Canal. And the CO now was Wing Commander Geoffrey Cheshire. And Wing Commander Cheshire called us into his office and said, your pilot has been grounded indefinitely because of his hearing problem. You have the choice of staying on and flying with another pilot or of being rested. Well, I had no doubt. We'd been on operational conditions now for well over a year, and I didn't want to fly with another pilot anyway, and I said I would prefer to be rested. And all the crew felt the same way. And so the crew broke up. We all went off to different training units, and I spent the next 6 months in 1944 teaching G, classrooms, 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and having a very relaxed time. In the evenings, we used to borrow bikes, go off to a pub, and play darts. And so we would have gone on until in November, Flight Lieutenant Wynn, a pilot instructor there, approached me and said he was going back on operations and would I like to go with him. And while I thought about it, he said, it's not a normal crew, a normal operational squadron. So he told me about it, and apparently it was one which would fly above the mainstream using American fortresses, and it would be carrying nothing but radar equipment. It was entirely devoted to jamming the German defences and assisting the bombing, the main bombing stream. And for this purpose, they would use this flying fortress, which would fly above our own aircraft. So I went back with him and became a member of a new crew. And we started, after familiarising ourselves with the fortress, we started operations and flew. We would fly along above the mainstream. We would circle the target while they attacked the target and then fly home in the same way. And this was quite useful.
You were flying what?
Flying fortresses, B-17s, American flying fortresses.
How did you find flying in those?
Well, they were very very good aircraft. They could go extremely high, and they were quite reasonably... they had excellent defences, of course, because we had at least two extra crew who would operate the guns. We had three gunners at least. And the rest of the crew, there were 10 crew on this aircraft, the rest of the crew would be either flying the aircraft and everything, or operating the various radar aids. And so we got used to this, and so we carried on and flew. No, okay. Is it on?
Yeah.
And so we carried on and would have carried on indefinitely until the 14th, 15th of March, 1945, we had been ordered to come back on this occasion at 6,000 feet. Why, I don't know, and I never found out. And as we approached the Franco-German border, the River Rhone, somewhere near Stuttgart, we were suddenly caught in a flak concentration which damaged the aircraft, ruined the port inner engine, and caused the propeller to vibrate furiously, shaking the whole aircraft. We immediately began to lose height, and the pilot, Johnny Wynn, asked me where we were. So I said, as well as I could tell, we had not been able to get any pinpoints for the last 3/4 of an hour, that we were approaching the Franco-German border, somewhere near Stuttgart, on the River Rhone. I hoped, as I told him this, and incidentally, I should say, as I sat there, the table with a chart on it was vibrating so badly, I had no possibility of drawing lines or writing on it. As I told him this, I hoped he would hold off as long as possible so that we could get well into France. But he came back immediately. He said, I'm sorry, we're losing height. Put your parachutes on. And he followed this up almost immediately with, it's no good, you'll have to get out. So I had my parachute on. I went forward. I sat in the nose of the fortress with the bomb aimer side by side. And I got up, climbed up the stairs and looked at Johnny as he sat there and waved at him, and he gave me a nod, and I went back in, and I sat in the, oh, there was a hatch, escape hatch in the nose. I sat with my feet dangling out of this hole. I'll make the right mess of this, won't I?
No, that's all right.
Well, Tubby, the bomb aimer, pointed to me to go, and we lifted the hatch, and it indicated me to sit down and go out first, which I did. I sat on there, and as I looked, it was completely black underneath. It had been a very, very dark night. And as I sat there, I got this thump in the back, and I was out. And it was suddenly, it was all quiet. It was very black and very quiet. There was not a sound, nothing to see. And I could feel myself turning over and over, and I sort of tried to correct it and stop this until I came to my senses, knew that I hadn't got much time to spare, and I pulled the ripcord and immediately was brought up with a jerk. And so I was in spinning for a while, and as I looked down, it was all dark, but it looked even darker immediately below me. And I thought, oh God, not a lake, I hope. But it wasn't a lake, but I landed immediately on top of an enormous building, spread eagled over the roof, you know, like that, you know. Legs one side, head the other. And I just lay there for a while, getting my breath back. I wasn't hurt. My flying clothing had saved me from that. And I sat up, collected my parachute together, and looked around, but I could hardly see anything at all. It was so dark. And as I sat there, I heard, I saw the lights of a vehicle. Very, very faint, real wartime vehicle lighting, approaching some distance away, and it looked as if it was going to go straight past and disappear in the distance. But it didn't. It turned off. And it came round, and it came right round this building and pulled up beside it. I could just about see it in the dark. And as it stopped, suddenly there were orders given, which are obviously German, guttural orders, and clatter of booted feet. And I know now, it's an open truck, and they all piled out of this truck into the building and came all round inside the building. So they're obviously looking for me. So I just huddled up against the roof of this with my parachute round me. Incidentally, I should say this thing had two roofs, and I sat on the lower one at the end with my back against the main roof. Out they went, clatter of feet out into the dark again. I could hear them climbing back up on the truck, and I thought, good, I got away with it. And then suddenly someone shone a torch on the roof. And immediately there were two or three rifle shots, and I automatically put my hands up. I wasn't hurt, I wasn't hit. Back into the truck, into the building they came, clattered around, broke down the wooden partition, and dragged me inside. They were very reasonable. They didn't hurt me. Took me down, put me on the truck, and off we went. And I spent the next 6 weeks in Germany as a prisoner, but...
In a camp?
No. I didn't know at the time, but the Allied forces on both sides, Russians and our own and the Americans particularly in the south of France, were very close. And all Germans, military people, were being moved away from the border, and we were sent marching. We marched for the next month, or walked rather, is more like it, walked for the next month under guard away from the advancing Allies. I should say that after a couple of days there, I found myself in a prison cell in a town, I think it was Ludwigsburg, where my was my wireless operator, Tommy Tate. And we managed to get talking. And it seemed that whereas the bomb aimer and I had boiled out the front, everybody else had gone out the back of the aircraft. And they'd taken longer over it, of course, seven of them, or eight of them, as I thought. Taken longer, and they'd all been picked up together some distance away from Tubby and I, picked up by the German army, and marched through a town which had been heavily bombed. And they were subject to much hostility from the German civilians, particularly Hitler Youth. Well, they were put in a cellar for the night under guard.
What kind of hostility? Physical?
Physical. Well, not physical, because they were under guard, but they were. You could tell they would have been physical if they hadn't had a guard. Shouting and all in German. I only go by what I've been told, of course. But they were put in a cellar overnight with under guard. And in the middle of the night, these people broke in, overpowered the guard, and dragged these prisoners out into the street. Seven of them. I got all this from Tommy, who was there. He and another man, Norman Bradley, managed to escape, although they were in their stocking feet, I think, or bare feet. Managed to escape in the confusion because there was so much violence. These people were all getting beaten up. And eventually we learned that they, or Tommy learned, that they had been taken to the nearest cemetery and shot, five of them. Tommy and Norman got away, and that's how I knew what happened.
Shot by the civilians?
Yeah, killed by the civilians. Now, I know this is all absolutely true because I have a cutting from my local newspaper many years later, which tells how, thanks to, mainly to Norman Bradley's efforts, these Hitler Youth were caught and dealt with. And I can show you that cutting. So it just shows these things can be done. For myself, Tommy and Norman, we joined up with various other POWs as time went on. Army, quite a large consignment of Indian Army who had been taken in the Western Desert in 1942, I suppose it was, 41-2. And we marched or stopped overnight or slept in fields, managed to get us some reasonable rations. And then one night when we'd slept in a village, in a hayloft, three of us, we looked out into the street and there was an American tank in the square. And so we knew it was all over.